I'm Karen, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm short. You know, when I was a kid and I lost my parents, and I could see them in relationship to other parents, and I saw that they were short, so I used to go in the closet and try to hang by the bar. Didn't work. I am really honored tonight to introduce the speaker tonight, Bill Kay from Toronto. The Detroit Conference means a lot to me. 4 years ago and 2 months and a couple of days, I had my last drunk. It started in Detroit. It ended up in Chelsea in the emergency room, but it started in Detroit. And I swore I would never come back to Detroit. Never. 2 months later and a couple of days later, I came back to the conference 4 years ago. And I must admit, I was a sick puppy. Very sick. Went to the hospitality suite, and then I met up with some folks. I know there's some people here from Pennsylvania, and I met a wonderful, wonderful person from Pittsburgh. And he knew I was sick. Puppy. Of course, he was caretaking then at the time, too. He has since gone into ACOA meetings, and he doesn't caretake as much. But he sort of took me under his wings, and gradually we met some folks, and some of those folks happened to be from Toronto. And we were talking about the Windsor connection last night. Well, I look at the Toronto connection, and that's, it seems like it's the Detroit-Toronto outstate, as you call it, connection. I met Bill informally, I think, at first. I'm not even sure. I was sick. In fact, for you newcomers, the only thing I do remember coming out of that first conference in Detroit was keep coming back, and together we can. And I got to tell you, that's all I remembered. And that's okay, because I kept coming back. And when I get into my eyes now and then, it's still, together we can. So I've chatted with Bill while we sat at banquet tables like this at the Gratitude Conference in Toronto and a couple of other occasions. And I've heard bits and pieces of his story, and I've seen his program work in the times that I have seen. And I got to tell you, I'm really anxious to hear. I'm sure I'm not going to hear the whole story, but I'm going to hear how he does it, and I'm really looking forward to that, and I hope you do too. So without further ado, would you help me welcome Bill Kay from Toronto.
An impressive array of microphones. Feel like I'm Governor Clinton or something. I could say that I took a drink of alcohol but didn't swallow it or something like that. However, that wouldn't have gotten me onto the podium tonight. I hope I can ride the wave of positive energy and emotion that is in the room. Today has really been a roller coaster of emotions for me, and unusually so. But the adrenaline really started to pump after dinner when I went out, because I was jittery, really, and was just pacing up and down the hall, and bumped into an old, long-time friend who I haven't seen for a number of years, and who had come in for the meeting after the dinner, and brought back so many memories. I know looking at me tonight, it's difficult to believe, but Kevin and I used to go on spearhead leather runs at the end of August every year, and it was a total drinking and drugging experience. And who would have thought that we would end up 9 years or whatever later here together sharing and enjoying recovery? Before I get into my actual story, I'm just going to do a little bit of preamble. I would like to thank Linda for inviting me. This is my first conference lead, and I can remember when I first came into the program and went to my first conference, and operating totally at that point on image and ego, and I saw the speaker and I thought, that's something I would like to do. I know I will just get my story in order, memorize it, and market it. And of course, I had no recovery and knew nothing about the program. And I've often thought every time I have spoken how the story changes in order and in importance and in feelings, as it should, each time out of the gate. And so there is no such thing as one story, but I find it quite amusing. And so Linda, I'm sure Linda knew she was dealing with an alcoholic when she phoned me and she asked me about my work hours, and she was considerably more conscientious about my hours than I am. And she phoned me back and told me that she was taking me out of Toronto on a 6 o'clock flight Friday night, and my first thought was, no time for primping nor shopping. And I gently asked her about changes, and she assured me quite firmly that there were no changes allowed on the ticket. And being a true alcoholic, I immediately set about to exert my will and change that. And I remember on a Saturday, perhaps in January, getting all dressed up and tucking my dog under my arm and going down to the Bloor Street offices of Air Canada, and seeing if I could chime them into it. And there was no way. I tried again with a phone call. But then, the wonder of sponsors. 3 nights before the conference to begin, my sponsor heard about my time. And so he knew somebody in Montreal who worked with Air Canada. And he changed the ticket. And when I phoned Linda, there was silence for a minute. And she has not asked me how that came about, to her credit. But I'm sure she hung up the phone and thought, well, at least know I've invited an alcoholic. To structure the story as the big book suggests it be done, by telling you what it was like and what happened and what it's like today. I was born in Ottawa, Canada, long ago and far away. I know I won't be able to get away with that much of a euphemism for long in the story, but that's what I'll start with. And I was born the youngest of 5 children to a working-class Irish family, Catholic. And we've already heard this weekend of some of the scenario that goes along with that. What seems to me to have been important about that childhood were 2 things. One, although I wasn't in a family that I would term in any way dysfunctional, the attitude to alcohol I did pick up. And the role of alcohol in my family was that whenever there was anything, either good or bad, you had a drink. If it was good, then you had a drink to celebrate, and if it was unfortunate news, then you had a drink to feel better. And I truly believe that, although it took many, many years to manifest itself in full-blown alcoholism, that I carried from childhood that attitude towards alcoholism. The second thing from childhood, of course, was the fact that I always, from the youngest age of that I can remember, felt different, and indeed was different. And that dis-ease just so permeated everything, of pretending to be one thing and knowing in my heart that I was different in terms of my sexual identity. And so that too carried on over the years, eventually combined with alcohol, brought me to where I am today. And although it would seem to be jumping far ahead in the story, I was sharing with someone at dinner tonight that I'm one of those who am truly so grateful to be an alcoholic, because I can't imagine where my life would have been if my life existed today had I not found the program. The changes have been just so sweeping and so immensely fundamental. And my life today is so happy that I can't help but really love to be at these conferences and with you people. However, to go back in the story, I'm going to move along somewhat to the point where I was coming out. And at that point, the real confusion and the real digression, the real going up the pathway, I think, began for me in terms of self-esteem. I didn't come out particularly young. I was in my early 20s. And I met a fellow in Ottawa who suggested that I was perhaps driving myself crazy by, at that time, engaged to a girl, and then I was going out after the dates and meeting men and so on. And he suggested I go to Provincetown. And to show the strength of the compulsion, that was a Friday night. I woke up Saturday morning. I approached my sister. I asked her if she had any cash. She said she did. She gave it to me. My parents were away shopping. I got in the car. I drove virtually nonstop from Ottawa to Provincetown. Went to the beach. Met people at the beach who invited me to the cocktail hour, and I saw men dance with men for the first time, and instantly I knew I was home. And while that, of course, was a positive good thing, the unfortunate thing for me was that I embraced a set of values that was totally superficial. And that although I had a substantial education and worked in teaching, I've been teaching high school for 32 years, and although I was teaching, I really just put that on the back burner. I did what I had to do to live in the bars. And that was really proven to me. I spent a summer holiday. I had a chance to go to California. And when I landed in California, I really felt that I'd reborn in every way. And I remember being in California and thinking that some terrible mistake had happened at my birth, and that I was born to the wrong parents in the wrong country, and that California just had to be the land of dreams for me. I went back to my teaching job in Toronto, immediately resigned, although this was September and I couldn't leave till the next June, but I handed in my resignation anyway. Immediately planned to get rid of the car and the apartment and move to California. And it was at that point, as I understand it today, that I began to substitute image for substance, and that as one therapist once told me, you know, that by the time I came into the program, I thought that I was just, as she put it, a hank of blonde hair and a wardrobe. And I lived my whole, what I saw as my meaningful life, in the bars, and the rest just a getting by. And I can remember one Christmas having to fly home to Ottawa, and it was truly having to, and crying in the bar because I felt that my true family, and I said that to them, was there, and that my biological family was just a circumstance. And so, I left California. I have a whole pattern of running when I get into relationships. And if I can't handle a relationship, then I simply leave. And I left California, came home briefly to Toronto to physically recover, but knew that I still wanted to give America just, you know, another chance. I still firmly believe that my destiny lay in America. And so I moved to New York, and it was interesting because I'd always said I disliked New York. But I did think it was an important and necessary place to have on your resume as a gay person to live in. And when I arrived in New York, I only wanted a part-time job because, as I've indicated, my full-time job was in the bars. And I just lived to be validated at night. If I met someone and went home with someone, then that was truly all that mattered. However, what was offered to me was a full-time contract, and once again I was seduced by money and agreed to it. And I told everybody at the school in my life that I was staying for 1 year and 1 year only. And I thought probably I would return to California at that time. The 1 year stretched to 2 to 3, at which point I stopped talking about one thing I would like to talk about in terms of the American experience, when I decided to move to California, and the story is a bit long, but I think it's worthwhile in that it captures for you vividly where my self-esteem was and where my image was. When I decided to move to California, I decided that Bill just would not cut it as a name. And I mean, I was not, you know, 15 years old at this point. I was, you know, approaching 30. And I think now that a person approaching 30 would sit down and go through a list of names to get one that he felt projected an image that suited whatever was in his head. And I can remember sitting at my dining room table with this list of names. And they were all, at that time, very California trendy names like Lance and Todd and one of them was Scott. And I remember having a very good friend over, and I said to him, "Barry, I have this list of names." And he looked at me quite askance. And I said, "I'm going to change name when I move to California because Bill is just, you know, it's all ordinary." So he was very quiet, and I read him through the list, and I said, "What do you think?" And he said, "Well, I don't know what's wrong with Bill." And I go, "Oh, Barry, you just don't understand. You haven't been to California." And as I prepared to go to California and I'd settled on Scott, not really thinking that, you know, Scott didn't go so well with my last name, which is just so overwhelmingly Irish. But anyway, and I was on the plane going out to California. And I thought, now on the plane, I must remember whenever anybody asks me my name that I've now changed it. And I was seated beside two nuns, which didn't seem like a very auspicious step for this California journey. And we were about halfway through the trip when finally they turned to me and very quietly asked what I did and what my name was. And I told them my name was Bill because that just didn't seem the right place to give birth to Scott. And so I, even though I'd broken my own vow, and I thought that was fine because of the circumstances. And I got to San Francisco and went to the hotel and immediately changed. At that time, the big bar and the hot bar was one called The Rendezvous. And I went to The Rendezvous and I went up and I went to the bar and I was, you know, as always, totally sort of projecting image. And the bartender asked me what I would like to drink, and I hadn't really somehow anticipated that. And I quickly looked up and down, because I always wanted to drink whatever other people were drinking. I didn't want to order something, and I wanted to drink whatever was the most popular beer. And I ordered it, And standing beside me was the quintessential, in my mind, California person that I wanted to be. That 6'2" and blonde and tan surfer. And because I hesitated, he said, "You must be out of town." And I said, "Yes, I was." And he said, "Where are you from?" And I said, "Toronto." And he said, "What's your name?" And I took a deep breath and I said, "Scott." And he said, "Gee," he said, "you really look like a Scott." And I thought, terrific, you see, I'm absolutely right. And I turned to him and I said, "What's your name?" And he said, "The funny but sad part of that story is that I had no sense of humor, no sense of self-worth, that I would have laughed and told him what a wonderful story was. I was to enter into a six-month relationship with this person, intimate relationship, never once told my true name, hid all my identification. I mean, quite clearly, the sickness of low self-esteem. And I really attribute it to that childhood and that adolescence, that not knowing who I was, being told and pretending I was one thing but being something else. Now, I must say that for many, many years, I enjoyed alcohol. There is a saying, I'm sure you've heard, but about alcohol gives one wings, but then it takes away the sky. And for many years, I enjoyed the wings. And it wasn't really until I moved to New York and began the teaching during the day and Fire Island on weekend and going out maybe four or five nights a week. And then I felt that I had to, in order to keep going, had to subsidize the alcohol with amphetamines during the day to get to when to teach, but then also sedatives at night in order to get any rest. And I juggled those for, I suppose, something like 7-8 years. The details are fuzzy, as you can imagine. What happened was, after 5 years in New York and numerous experiences that aren't really particularly pertinent to the story of being held up at gunpoint twice, once at Harlem at midnight, and all sorts of stories like that. But the point that is valid is that I really felt burnt out, and was burnt out. And as I see it now, I thought, I'll go back to Toronto. I'll go back to that kinder, gentler place and pick up my life where I left off, and things will be fine. Well, two things had changed, of course. I had changed substantially, and Toronto and its scene had changed substantially. And so I was in for an enormous disappointment. Of course, the minute that I resigned my job in New York, I got involved in a relationship. And so when I moved to Toronto, I left relationship, moved back to a city that had changed, and that really began the decline as I see it today. And here my story sort of falls into two segments. One, I would like to go over a few of the facts that describe my bottom. And that's why talking is so important, because after a number of years in the program and a number of years living life as we see it tonight in these rooms, we sometimes forget, I sometimes forget where I came from. Some of those sad stories and tragic stories, I suppose, is that I got arrested for drunk driving. I claim, still somewhat to this day, that it was a political setup because the police picked me up outside the gay bar. But, however, if I was not truly guilty that night, there had been many, many nights when I was guilty. And, the minute they picked me up, I can remember every detail of that evening, unfortunately or fortunately. And they took me to a police cell, And I was sitting in the police cell, and they made me take off my belt and take my shoelaces off and so on. And I can remember feeling so totally degraded and wondering what my parents and my family would think. However, it was to be a number of years before there were enough different incidents. Another incident I remember was, there was a story in the big book about, you know, shaking all night. And I can remember times. Now, it's true they weren't all consecutive. I would go on binges, and then there would be a period of time when I'd pull it together. There were times when, many times, when I would leave school at lunchtime and go to a nearby restaurant and have four or five quick glasses of wine to control the shakes. And then after four or five glasses of wine, we'll eat a sandwich and then go back, somehow get through the afternoon. I can remember at least two occasions to drink at school, once in the book room and once in the classroom during exam time when the students weren't there and marking exams. And somehow thinking, well, I don't know what I was thinking. I must have thought it was okay at the time, or it would have brought me to the program sooner. I remember also once going into a wine store and having the shake so badly that I couldn't get the bottle of wine off the shelf. And there was a dear, sweet grandmother-type lady running the store, and she got it for me. She put it in a bag, and she said, "Now you go drink this, dear, and then you should go and phone AA." That store is so vivid. I mean, I know the intersection, the corner of, you know, Girard and Coxwell, East End, Toronto. And I took the bottle of wine out, and I got the top off. I picked the type of the scoop type, because that was the most I could manage. The same incident, after her telling me this, and I was getting it on the street, the police cruiser stopped. It's 9:45 in the morning. No, it must have been after 10, because liquor stores are open to 10, but whatever. And it was morning, and he stopped me, and he poured the wine down a sewer grate, had me sit in the cruiser, and he asked me questions. The truth was that I was trying to get to my doctor's. I had a doctor's, but I had to get straightened out enough to get to the doctor's and get the shakes under control. And he asked me what I did and so on. And he said, "You're insane. Why are you jeopardizing a job like this by drinking?" And I said, "Well, that's why I'm going to see my doctor." And he hailed a cab. Well, he gave me a $58 ticket, but he hailed a cab for me. I got in the cab, and the cab driver, and it was really a blessing at that time, was an alcoholic. And he said to me, "What you need is a drink, not a doctor." And he stopped at another wine store that had chilled white wine. Mine had warm stuff, so he knew the better source. And he gave him, I was still giving him $10, and he went in and picked up the bottle of wine. And as he drove me to a doctor's appointment out in Bathurst, I drank the wine, and my only concern on the way out there was that with him driving and hitting bumps and me drinking, that I would chip one of my cap teeth on the way to the doctor's. And I got to the doctor's, and of course she wasn't particularly pleased with where I was at. And perhaps for me one of those poignant times was during one summer holiday, and summers were always the worst because I didn't have to pull myself back, walking along the boardwalk in Toronto and crying. I remember that so vividly, crying because everybody seemed to be having so much fun and such a good time, and I was in such pain and did not know what to do about it. And of course, I finished that bottle and then fell asleep in the park and so on. So life was just that series of stories and many more like them. My first entry into AA came, I'd gone away to Skate Canada. I'm a great figure skating fan, and I'd gone away to Skate Canada with one of my dear friends, and what I didn't know was that she came from an alcoholic family. She knew all the signs and all the symptoms. And I was drinking in the morning from a glass that I hidden underneath the bed. And when we got, she was strangely silent all the last day. And when we got back, she wrote me a letter telling me, you know, that she hoped she didn't lose me as a friend, but that I displayed all the classic signs of an alcoholic and needed help. And she had someone, a friend who is still my friend today, and who many of you know, Pierce, M from Toronto, phoned me, and I wasn't really ready. And so when he came to the house, I disappeared. When he phoned and asked if he could come, I said yes, and then I got panicky, left a note in the door, and went to the nearest restaurant and ordered a bottle of wine. However, I did start going to AA meetings. And if I sound hesitant at this point, it is that my first venture, my fault or whatever, was not a successful one. I went to AA with the illusion that many of us have that if I went for a period of time that I could learn how to drink and then I could graduate. And so I didn't want to become too enmeshed. I didn't want to become too connected. So I didn't go to step meets because they were a little intense, I thought. And so I only went to open meetings where the speaker was fairly entertaining, I hoped. And I can remember being at a meeting and asked me to be librarian, and I turned it down because, the job ran for 6 months, and I intended to, have finished my studies by that time. And so I went in January, and by May, which is my birthday, my biological birthday, I thought, okay, now I'm ready to go out. Now, in that short period of time, and for those who have any doubts about what happens when you stop and go back, that was May the 2nd when I picked up my first drink. By June the 15th, I was in such bad shape that I came home from school with all the exams, went on a bender, never did return to school. Yes. Many calls on my answering machine, people banging on my door, my principal, because I had all the exams, I had all the final end of year results. I was hiding out because I was so sung out. I finally, some shape or form, got the exams marked and sent them in a cab. But we were, as you imagine, near the end at this point. By early July, on a Sunday night, I decided I was going to quit. Now, because I've been drinking such a stretch, I have no idea today what made me decide that night I was going to stop, what the final thing was. It was nothing traumatic, particularly. I decided I would stop on a Sunday night. By Tuesday, I was in such dreadful shape. I could have died. I thought I was having convulsions and so on because I live alone. And I phoned Pierce and I said, I've been out. And he said, yes, I know. And and he came over. And at that time, I was just so dastardly sick. And he thought for a day that he could sort of bring me soup and so on. We could sort of pull me around. And after a day, I just was getting sicker. And by this time, he was getting frightened. And so he came to my house looking very somber. And he said, I've talked with a number of people on the program, and they think you should go into a detox. Well, I was sick, but not too sick not to cause a scene. And I just screamed that I couldn't possibly go to a detox and that I wanted to go to Wellesley Hospital. So he said, okay. So he said, provided we could even get you to Wellesley Hospital, what would we do there? And so ultimately, after about half an hour, I saw the wisdom, whatever his ways, and I went to a detox, and what was 3 day stay turned into a 10-day stay because they didn't know the amount of sleeping pills and amphetamines I was on. And after 3 days, I was just worse and couldn't even walk. And I went from there into a 28-day treatment center, and for which I'm enormously grateful. It would appear a day at a time that has been sufficient exposure to alcohol and drugs. Now, as you've heard, I came into AA, as the saying goes, to save my ass, but in AA I found that was connected to my soul. And thus my comment at the beginning of my talk, how the program has just totally changed my values and my life. And this has always been the difficult part of the talk to to deal with the part of today, I also know that it's the most important. And I'm just going to touch today on a few areas, some of which I've learned to manage and some of which I haven't. From the beginning, my single greatest character defect has been intolerance. No surprise, I'm sure, to many. The inability, except the very rigorous work, to keep an open mind. The fact that my first inclination is to be judgmental. I attribute it somewhat to having such an extended career in the bar circuit, where you judged everybody solely on superficial images and values. However, I'm not one of those people who spends a great deal of time trying to analyze how I got to be either an alcoholic or how I got to be gay, but rather dealing with the reality of it. And what I do know today is that when I am experiencing those feelings, that it's invariably tied into my expectations of others and my expectations of myself. And I had a very vivid example of that today. The day began well, and by about noon, I was working myself into what I could see was, you know, not a particularly healthy frame of mind. I suppose it was a combination of anxiety about tonight, a combination of, when I went to my room and sat down for about 5 minutes, a realization of my expectations of us. And throughout the program, I've relied on one paragraph in the big book more than any other. And ironically, it's a paragraph that's not even in my copy of the big book. I was given the big book by a man who was not able to grasp the program, but he understood the benefits of the program, and he gave it to me, and for sentimental reasons, I took the copy. But it does not have the story of the doctor alcoholic addict in it. But one night at a meeting, I heard this paragraph read, and I can't tell you the number of times I've borrowed friends' books and taken and had this page dropped. And that's the paragraph, of course, about that acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. And that when I'm disturbed, it's because I find some person, place, or thing unacceptable to me, and that I can find no serenity and no peace until I've accepted that, and that it's me that has to be changed. And so, sitting in my room, I thought, well, each person has their own method of getting out of these moods. If I stay in the hotel, I'm not sure that I'm just not going to get more angst entwined. So, although it may sound superficial, and maybe it is, I know that the answer is for me to get out of the building, for one thing. Invariably, get out into the sunshine and wind and walk. And if that involves shopping, even if it's unlooking, but it was just a little bit more, not a whole lot more than that, just one pair of jeans, but that somehow I can turn that mood around. And I think it's simply, quite frankly, my method of getting out of my head and out of my feelings and out into some different environment. Now, for someone else, the answer might have been to have gone to yet another workshop or, you know, talk to someone or phone their sponsor. Everyone has their own. But, I mean, I had been to workshops in the morning, and I was just afraid that unless I used tried and true. And so I approached Linda, who was sitting in the out here on a sofa, and I said, Linda, and part of my problem, of course, is that I was feeling trapped in a sense, and that, you know, how many of us love control. And to be here without a car and as a guest and not have control sort of where I went and what I did to that extent. So I went to Linda and I said, how far is it to walk to the nearest mall? And she said, oh, it's far. So I hope Linda doesn't mind this story, but it's too late now. I'm into it. And I said, I'm a good walker. So I said, if it's 10 miles to the mall, then it's too far. But if it's only 2 miles, and she said, oh, I don't even think it's two. I said, well, then I'm off. And down the stairs I went, and I asked the man at the front desk, and he pointed out, and I went the wrong direction, which is pretty much the story of my recovery, I suppose, in many ways. And but I went all the way the wrong way to the wrong, whatever, mile road, and then turned around, but I was determined I was not going to be disappointed. Walked all the way to the mall, and the minute I set foot in the mall, I just suddenly, my spirit was, in a sense, all that entanglement and that, you know, feeling of resentment or disappointment or plans that hadn't gelled the way I would have liked them to have. And so I spent a happy couple of hours there by myself, just walking up and down in and out of stores, and came back and felt so much better for it. But again, it's that acceptance that the problem lies within me, and that I'm free each day and in each situation to choose to either make it a good one and it will be good, or I can choose to make it bad and continue along that road until I've had enough of that. I know conferences are times when people love to talk about relationships. You will be relieved in terms of time to know that I apparently know absolutely nothing constructive nor positive about relationships. Mine have all been various levels of disaster. I will tell you a little bit about the last one, because if nothing else, it was the springboard for enormous growth. And people tell me I should be so grateful to this person for the growth that he enabled me to have. However, on a good days I can, but many days the pain was just so enormous. And so what happened was, when I was 2 years sober, and I listened to my sponsor and the people on the program who said not to get into relationships the first year. And I just assumed that after you'd put in the time of 1 year, you had paid your dues and you were now ready for a relationship. Not that one, that I'd put in 2 years. So I was certain to have a successful relationship. And I'd gone to the Montreal, the big 50th or whatever AA conference in Montreal, and went home to visit my parents in Ottawa, met a young man. Now, what I didn't pay attention to, of course, was that he didn't have a year. He had like 9 months. And entered into a relationship. And it was the classic for me. But fortunately, the fortunate thing this time was that I did have 2 years. And so when a few months later he just disappeared out of my life and left me totally in a shambles, that I did know to go to AA meetings every night, to share, and it didn't matter, and that was the first time, it didn't matter if it was a straight meeting or a gay meeting, I told that story around Toronto, I'm sure ad nauseum. I also went into therapy, and so in that sense, it was an enormous growth-inspiring experience. However, the interesting aspect is that since that date, I have not risked relationships. I did get a dog 2 years ago. And although people laugh, and I understand the laughter, I'm one of those who subscribe to the theory that it's important to love something, whether it be a pet or a person, and that's a step. And the reason it's important for me is that it gets me out of myself until the dog came along, all I thought about from when I woke up first thing in the morning was what I needed. And now it's something other than me whose needs come first. So I think that's healthy. Now, whether or not that's ever going to be healthy enough to get me into another human relationship of an intimate nature remains to be seen. I'm well aware that one of the reasons I'm staying away is that relationships are the truest mirror of all, and that it's in relationships that you truly face yourself and your self-centeredness and your willingness to compromise and all those things. And so while my life, as I see it, is enormously happy, I must be honest and say that is one mountain that I have not successfully climbed. I'd like to close by talking a little bit about conferences and what they've done for me. During my time in AA, I've done some of the do things, not all of them. I have worked the phones. I have gone and taken a 2-year stint at going and speaking to prisons on Sunday. I actually thought that would be a sort of kinkier experience than it turned to be, but I took it for the wrong reasons, but I did pay my dues for 2 years. But one of the greatest growth experiences, and you notice I don't necessarily say happy, the greatest growth experiences was working on the Gratitude Conference in Toronto. And I worked on the program, and I also in the same year had a large part in the entertainment show. And what that did for me was give me the confidence to be able to follow something that I've had as a dream on a back burner since I was a child, and that is to perform. And although my teaching in the English classroom gave me ample experience, so many of those elements, it isn't theater in its truest and total sense. And so following Gratitude, I had the courage to audition for Fruit Cocktail, which some of you may have seen, which the gay community is on every 2 years. And I had a role in that. And subsequently, I've been able to go on and perform in theaters in Toronto. And so thanks to the wonderful gifts that the program has given me, come this June, I am eligible for, it sounds, the word still seems strange to me, but I'm eligible to take early retirement. And so I am stepping down teaching after 33 years this June, and not without, as you can imagine, some anxiety and some excitement, and I'm stepping down to pursue, hopefully, a career in performance. And I know when I give thanks at night, and I give thanks usually in the same order. I give thanks for the environment that my power has given me. I give thanks for the companionship, and I give thanks for the courage to change and the courage to go on and follow and change the cassettes in your head and follow some of those other dreams. And it's a far richer and more powerful life than I could have ever imagined. And so, having had the wings taken away when I was drinking, I was able to come into the program and truly find that AA and you people were the wind beneath the wings for all of us. Thanks very much.